Representative Sherry Bustos has been taking more of a leadership role within the Democratic Party. She's now the fifth-ranking House Democrat and in charge of making sure the party wins House elections across the country.
We have the Speaker of the House, the Majority Leader, the Whip. Everybody on that list is coastal. What's good, I hope, for the state of Illinois, for the Midwest, and for my own district is that I have a seat at the leadership table.
Plus, around $300 million in funding from the National Science Foundation each year goes to researchers in Illinois. Its COO joins us to talk about how last month's shutdown affected not just its operations, but scientific research across the country. And during his Simon Says segment, NPR host Scott Simon is never shy with his opinions like this.
Are we booming or about to bust?
What will he say during today's conversation with me here at NPR in Washington? Stay tuned to the 21st to find out. We'll get started after the latest news. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting from NPR headquarters in Washington. Coming up later this hour, the National Science Foundation provides about $300 million a year to fund academic research in Illinois. Its chief operating officer joins us, and we'll sit down with an Illinoisan who needs no introduction to longtime public radio listeners. I'm talking about NPR's Scott Simon. But first, we're now about 6 weeks into the new Congress, which has a Democratic House and a Republican Senate. The year started off with a government shutdown. Of course, tomorrow at midnight is the deadline for lawmakers and the president to avoid another one. But congressional leaders are also looking ahead to 2020, not just because there will be a presidential election, but because every single member of the House, including the Democrats who swept into power this year, will have to win another election. Sherry Bustos is one of those leaders who's thinking hard about how to keep the majority that Democrats have won. After winning her own re-election easily in a district that also voted for President Trump, she was elected chair of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Today, she's the fifth-ranking Democratic House member. Representative Bustos represents Illinois' 17th district, which includes parts of Peoria, Rockford, and the Quad Cities, and I had a chance to speak with her from her office at the DCCC earlier this morning. Sherry Bustos, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So I wondered if we could just start with the big news that everyone's talking about in the Capitol, which is that there seems to be an agreement in principle. There's now details of the bill that would avert another government shutdown tomorrow. How are you feeling now about the House passing this today?
Here's what I feel good about. The fact that we had Democrats, Republicans, House members, and senators work on this from a policy perspective. I'm on the Appropriations Committee now, and so the chairman of the Appropriations Committee, Nita Lowey, out of New York, she met with all the Appropriation Committee members yesterday, and she started out by saying, in good governing, you don't get everything you want. So this is not the bill that she would have written or that I would have written, but it's a compromise, and the hope is that we get this through and that the president signs it into law.
So what did you feel like you had to give up in there?
Well, you know, I mean, we talked a lot about this. The wall, which has become symbolic really on both sides, right? The candidate Trump, for a couple years before he was elected, talked nonstop about the wall and how Mexico was going to pay for this wall. And Democrats have kind of dug their heels in and see the wall as symbolic for keeping people out of our country. So I think it's become more symbolic than it is. It's not good policy, period. But what we got out of it is we got good border security, keeping our own nation safe from a perspective of using technology, filling vacancies that we have for customs agents, taking a look at the number of beds and making sure that if people are in these beds, that they are folks who hopefully are seeking asylum and that we can integrate into our country. Keep criminals out and, you know, help good people. I hope in the end that's what we get out of this.
So we are here at the offices of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Lots of folks know it as the DCCC. You were elected chair late last year. I think maybe that's a DCCC is a term people know a lot in Washington. I wonder how journalists know about it. But how do you think this helps people back in Illinois?
Well, so I'll explain maybe a little bit for your listeners who don't know much about what the DCCC. I mean, out here we call it the D-Trip for short, but it's the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. It is the political arm of House Democrats. And so it basically means that I am running the political operation for making sure that Democrats, we're in the majority now in the House, that we hang on to that majority, and where we have opportunities that we grow our majority. So over these next 2 years, in addition to my role as being a member of Congress and working on legislation and you know, making sure that we're taking good care of people who need our help back home on, you know, veterans issues, Medicare, Social Security, all of that, this is an additional role on top of that, and it's the political part of my job.
And I wonder how you think your work within your district and what you hear from your constituents is forming that ideas or policy or direction of the Democratic Party.
Well, I'm the only Midwesterner sitting around the senior leadership table among House Democrats. So we have the Speaker of the House, the Majority Leader, the Whip, our Caucus Chair, Caucus Vice Chair, and everybody on that list is coastal. What's good, I hope, for the state of Illinois, for the Midwest, and for my own district is that I have a seat at the leadership table. What does that mean for folks back home? Well, I hope it's kind of that Midwestern sensibility. And in my case, I come from a district that Donald Trump won. There's not too many Democrats who come from districts that Donald Trump won. And I happen to have won by 24 points. So I won by the largest majority of any Democrat in the U.S. House of Representatives, where Donald Trump won the district also. So I hope that people at home see me as somebody who's willing to work together for results and for the good of our country, for the good of our state and our region.
I'm here with Representative Sherry Bustos, who represents Illinois' 17th Congressional District, which includes parts of Peoria, Rockford, and Quad Cities. And I wanted to ask you about some House movement. I know earlier last month there was a bill that was introduced for universal background checks for gun regulation. Today is the anniversary, unfortunately, last year at this time of the Parkland shooting. The Marjorie Stoneman Douglas kids have been very vocal about gun control. And I first just want to ask you about how you feel about this bill and its chances for passing in the House.
So it was a little more than a year ago that the students from Florida who were, you know, witnesses to the murders at their high school or had friends who were murdered, they came out to Washington. And they went around and met with different members of the House and the Senate. And I had about a half a dozen of the kids come into my office, and I asked them what they wanted me to know. I mean, it was an emotional meeting. I guess I should start by saying that. But I asked them what did they want from members of Congress. We're in a position, obviously, where we can talk about legislation, and we have a megaphone where we can amplify talk. And their parting words to me is they wanted us to do something that would pass and could become law. And so, to your question, criminal background checks, I think, is something that we can get done. It is, you know, while we don't have, I don't think every Republican will support this, but I think it is a reasonable piece of legislation that I hope will keep guns away from criminals. But if you are a law-abiding citizen and you want to hunt or go to the shooting range, that you're able to have a weapon. And I think it's always important when you look at guns that you differentiate. You know, my husband's the sheriff of Rock Island County. We have three sons, and they all hunt. And our oldest son finished second in the nation in collegiate trap shooting. So, but we don't break the law. And so I just always think it's important to differentiate between keeping guns away from people who should not have them and making sure that if you're a law-abiding citizen and you want to, if you're a sportswoman or man or you want to hunt, that there's nothing wrong with that.
To your point about Republicans, yesterday we spoke with another member of the delegation, Rodney Davis, and he said this wasn't a bill he could support because he didn't feel like it would necessarily make a difference. He said the question he asks himself is, would this make a difference in a school shooting like Parkland? And he didn't think it would have made a difference. I wonder what your response is to that.
That, back to what we were talking about earlier, you don't always get everything you want. But there's a call for action when it comes to making sure that we do what we can in a divided government, meaning Republicans control the Senate, Democrats control the House, and we have a Republican in the White House. Where can we come together? I guess my question back to Rodney Davis is, what will he support? And I don't know if he answered that question, but, you know, have a sit around the table and present something that he will support, because it is not an answer to do nothing. That is not the answer. And anybody who sat down with the kids who lived through that shooting and lost classmates when they're, you know, these kids are 16, 17, 18 years old. And, you know, it is not okay to do nothing. And so, like, whether it's Rodney Davis or whether it is anybody who says they don't support criminal background checks, what will they support?
We've been looking at everyone's schedules for the week and who they're meeting with, and we know that a lot of the community colleges from Illinois have been out here this week meeting with folks. And I wanted to ask you, I know you've met with them. I wonder what you see the biggest needs as community colleges in your district and how different that is from four-year institutions.
I love community colleges. I think they are a critical part of our economic future. They are affordable. They are nimble in how they adapt their curriculum. They partner with local businesses to make sure that as there are needs, whether it's welding or whether it's fixing locomotives, for instance, out of Carl Sandburg College in Galesburg, where BNSF, the rail company, is the largest employer there. I think as far as the needs going forward is we've got to look at partnerships. So the community colleges, and they are already doing this, so this is actually kind of a tip of the hat to how well they're doing at this, partnering with K-12 to make sure that kids who need dual credit when they come out of high school, they can already have college credit, partnering with the local businesses to make sure that we can meet the needs of the local community, but then bringing it, the answer to our economic success in the future is the private sector, the public sector, the nonprofits, education, even the faith community, federal, local, state, county, government, everybody coming together. That's how we're going to succeed in every region of the state of Illinois, throughout the Midwest, throughout our country. It's always got to be involved with partnering.
And I wonder how you feel that convening is happening, how well that's going when there's been such a focus in this first Congress on a shutdown and a government not working and so much energy and attention being devoted to this particular crisis as opposed to these issues, which are very much part of the everyday governing that you were elected to do.
Yeah, that 35-day shutdown was an absolute waste of everybody's time, energy, effort. It was an $11 billion hit to our economy. We had 800,000 federal workers who weren't paid, and there was just a report out on how many of those workers had to dip into their savings, how many had to dip into their retirement, how many missed mortgage payments, car payments. I mean, it was incredibly unfair to every one of those workers. It was a waste of everybody's energy. But let's hope that the president will sign this today and we can get down to business. And the first order of business has to be bringing down the cost of health care. I hear it every time I go home, including prescription drug prices. It's hurting too many families. We've got to pass a robust Rebuilding America package, an infrastructure package for our roads, our bridges, our locks and dams, airports, rail, all of that. That will rebuild our country and help raise people's wages. And then lastly, cleaning up and it's a real mess in Washington, the secret money that enters politics that nobody knows where it comes from, the self-dealing. Let me just give the one example that Donald Trump made $40 million in his first year in office at the Trump Hotel, where you have foreign visitors staying there and spending money, making sure that Donald Trump got that money. That is a clear violation of, you know, not a word we all use in everyday sentences, but the emoluments clause. It is a clear violation of that. And, so cleaning all of that up as well. So those are our first orders of business now that hopefully after the president signs this, we get down to business.
So I want to ask you one last question. It's something we've been asking both new and returning members of the delegation, which is what you miss most about Illinois when you're here other than your family.
I love Frank's Pizza in Silvis, Illinois. It is my Friday night hangout, and it is when I'm home. Typically, we have three sons, and two of our three sons live in the Quad Cities, so we'll go out for pizza and beer and have time with the family, but it is literally the best pizza anywhere you're going to go. And by the way, number two, I think, is I love Gabbatoni's out of Springfield, too. I grew up there.
Such a good political answer.
Well, that's what I grew up eating. So, but for the last, 35 years, I've been eating Frank's Pizza, and it's our Friday night ritual. And I cannot wait at the end of the week when I'm home, being able to go there and have a great pizza and have a couple beers. So it's a great family way to end the week, especially after some of these weeks that we've had lately.
Representative Bustos, thanks for taking the time to speak with
us.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Representative Sherry Bustos. We spoke with her earlier this morning, and as we mentioned, the details of the agreement to fund the government have been released. It would fund 9 federal agencies until September 30. The House and Senate are hoping to pass it this evening so President Trump can sign it before midnight on Friday. We've been in Washington all week, but we're still keeping an eye on the latest news back home in Illinois. Democrats and the General Assembly have been moving quickly on a bill that would raise the state's minimum wage to $15 an hour over the next 6 years. Governor J.B. Pritzker and Democrats in the legislature want to have this bill signed into law before Wednesday. It's already passed the Senate, and the House could bring the vote to the floor as early as today. And as Governor Pritzker said last week, this would raise the minimum wage in every corner of Illinois.
Workers in East St. Louis and Peoria doing the same job deserve to be paid the same wage as workers in Chicago. A 6-year period will allow businesses time to plan and adapt to this legislation.
Thanks to the State Journal Register for that audio of Governor J.B. Pritzker. We'll be keeping an eye on this bill, which could become law in the next few days. Coming up after the break, we're going to be speaking with NPR's Scott Simon, and you can join us. You can tweet us at 21STShow or give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Stay tuned. Stay close. We'll start that conversation just after the break.
Support comes from Prairie Melody Premium Black Oil Sunflower Birdseed. Prairie Melody is locally grown, supporting farms in transition to organic production. Information about local retail outlets and more at prairiemelodybirdseed.com/blog. Prairie Melody, it's all about the birds and the bees.
Back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and if you're a regular NPR listener, you know the voice of Scott Simon. He wakes you up on Saturday mornings, perhaps before you've even had your coffee or walked your dog, and he's been doing this for more than 30 years. You may also know that before Scott Simon sat on the mic at NPR in D.C., he was born and raised in Illinois and worked as the NPR bureau chief in Chicago. And so when we decided to come out to do our week of shows in Washington, we had to extend an invite to Scott to join us. Scott Simon, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for asking. It's always good to be back in Illinois. I think, you know, like the way foreign embassies here in Washington, D.C. is
so
a little bit of the country.
You're the Illinois.
I like certainly I am, and I like to think this studio today is a part of Illinois, too.
And those of you listening, of course, back in Illinois, are welcome to join us. If you have questions for Scott, tweet us. Our handle's 21STShow. You can give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. Scott, I wanted to actually start with a serious question, because there's been a lot of talk in Washington about how difficult it is for journalists to cover this administration. But I think people in Illinois have known for years, and journalists have known for years, how difficult it has been to cover our governors,
that's part of the job.
Our Chicago mayors, Chicago's your hometown. I wonder what you think the Washington Press Corps could learn from Chicago journalists.
Well, you know, the thought occurred to me, I guess it was a few weeks ago, I forget the exact date, when apparently a White House functionary took the microphone out of Jim Acosta's hands. I think I can say on pretty good authority that would not have happened in Springfield or Chicago. at least if a functionary of the governor or the mayor of Chicago would try to take the microphone out of the hands of a working reporter, I think
the other journalists
would have said something. I think there would have been some kind of action. I think they would have said, well, then nobody's asking a question. Thank you very much. I think in both Chicago and Springfield, there's more of a sense of rivalry, but professional congeniality and cooperation at the same time, and an understanding that when you're covering the government, if it's the governor, if it's the mayor of Chicago, professional, and you can even be friendly, but in the end, it is a professional adversarial relationship, and that's just part of the territory on both sides. It doesn't mean you can't be civil, but it does mean that you have to be aggressive.
Mm. So we are here this week. Tuesday was Lincoln's birthday, and we visited the President's Cottage and the Lincoln Memorial. And I should note to our audiences, you have to receive the Order of Lincoln,
yes,
which is our state's highest honor.
Greatest honor of my life. Well, and my marriage and my children. But after that, the greatest honor of my life.
I read, Scott, that your mother, who you so lovingly wrote about in your book, Unforgettable, was a Civil War scholar and that she worked at a Lincoln bookstore. Did you grow up knowing a lot about the war and President Lincoln?
No, actually, my mother was a chorus girl. She married Ralph Newman, who owned the Abraham Lincoln Bookshop in Chicago, and to a degree became a Lincoln scholar. She used to do a one-woman show as Julia Dent Grant, who was married to Ulysses S. Grant, who happened to be cross-eyed, by the way. And my mother, I can't say she became cross-eyed when she did the one, you know, she would do the show before Civil War roundtables, before civic groups. She would really go all over the state being Julia Dent Grant. And she learned an awful lot about the Civil War, Ulysses S. Grant, about the Grant family. She was terrific doing that show where she represented, I think it's fair to say, a kind of overlooked figure in history. And so, but at the time I was growing up, it was before she married Ralph. I was in my late teens when
that
happened.
Okay, so you didn't know that part of, I wonder what.
I've learned it subsequently. Yes. I certainly hope I've learned it subsequently. I think anybody who lives in Illinois is lucky enough to be imbued with a feeling for Lincoln and great pride and really kind of a provisional relationship in the fact that, you know, your state is forever identified with, I think we can safely say, the greatest of U.S. presidents. And, you know, I have no problem in saying to people, and I like to think since it falls on both Republican and Democratic sides, Illinois has not sent a lot of men or women to the White House. But when we do, it counts for something, doesn't it?
So, as I mentioned, people spend their Saturday mornings with you, and I think that's obviously very different from speaking to a weekday audience. You don't imagine people sitting at their desk or commuting.
No.
They might be in their pajamas or making pancakes.
Oh, they let us know they're in their pajamas or not even in their pajamas, okay. If I'm going to put it
that
way. Oh,
no.
Yeah, right,
I wonder how that changes.
I try not to think about that part too much.
Yeah, I was going to say, don't think about that part, but does it change how you think about addressing the listener?
Yes and no. Not in the actual moment that I'm doing the show, because I think the fact that even if they are starkers doesn't mean they're not interested in what's going on in the world and the news that's breaking all over the world. But I do think that we really, and some weeks it's a struggle, we want to have the latest breaking news that's up to the minute. And increasingly, we have to do that. That's just the demands of the business. But at the same time, I think it's important to have art. I think it's important to have literature. I think it's important to have everything that contributes to a fully rounded human life. And we make a place for that on our show. And sometimes, I mean, the daily shows try to, too, but I think it becomes a bigger proportion of the shows we do. And sports, for that matter. I don't think anybody who listens to our show is surprised to learn that I'm a sports fan.
Particularly. I don't think you'll be surprised to learn that I have some Cubs questions for you later. Yeah, but first, I just wanted to ask you about, do you get a weekend? Or how does this work for you?
Well, yes. I mean, I'm off Sunday and Monday, although I frequently work one way or another on Monday, travel somewhere, report something. I also do stories for CBS Sunday morning, and that typically I have to take off on a Sunday and Monday and do that. But yes, of course I get a weekend. That's important to me. I've got two young children.
So our audiences, I know, love to hear from you, and you do a lot of interviews like this, I imagine. So when we got to NPR, we asked your colleagues what people might not know about you.
Oh, no.
Everyone said, don't worry. Yeah. This is the answer everyone said. He's very well-dressed. And I should point out to our radio audience that they do not realize you were wearing, you have a jacket with a pocket square that has red stars, that is Valentine's Day themed. Do you think of yourself as fashionable?
I don't think of myself as fashionable, but I think of myself as a middle-aged man who has no problem looking the part. And as you probably observed from being around here at NPR a few days, a man who wears hard-soled shoes here is considered to be some kind of Beau Brummel. so it's not exactly a high bar to meet. My mother worked, she sold Schmata's on Michigan Avenue for many years at iMagnet at Marshall Field. At Lord & Taylor, and so it was always important. You know, my father was in show business. He was a comedian, and his motto in life was think Yiddish, dress British. And I've tried to do that. I think I wrote in the book Unforgettable, my mother always said to me, imagine if you were clipped by a car and they had to bring you into the emergency room. Do you want to be the guy wearing a jacket and a pocket square, or the guy wearing an Arctic Monkeys suck it and see T-shirt? You know, who do you think is going to get more consideration from the doctors? And
I think you really have your finger on the pulse of NPR fashion with
that
Arctic Monkeys.
Yeah, you've seen a lot of those T-shirts out there, I'm sure. Yeah.
So another NPR staffer said we should ask you about France. Yeah. And I gather you have a special relationship to the country. You tweeted last year that you married proudly into a French family.
Yes, my wife is French from Normandy. Caroline Richard, I married into the Richard family. We were able to spend a few weeks of the year in Normandy. And we refer to ourselves actually as a Chicago-Normandy family. Because both Chicago and Normandy, of course, part of the United States and France, but I think they're both utterly distinct places in both the United States and France. So we're very proud of that. The history in Normandy is extraordinary. Not to mention the seafood. I hate to go on about that, but it's extraordinary. And I'm very proud of the fact that our daughters, who, as you may know, happen to be adopted from China, are bilingual. They are fluent in French. And it was very funny. I think one of the first years in grade school for our oldest daughter, they asked her to fill out a form and asked if there was another language that was spoken at home, and she said yes. And because she was born in China, they assumed it was Chinese. So they put her in a Chinese.
They put her in a Chinese language class. Oh no!
And she said, "Yeah, as a matter, I have no problem in telling you the one word." And we brought them to Mandarin immersion classes for 3 years. But as we say in our family, you can drag the girl to Mandarin class, but you can't make them speak. The one they can sing the carrot harvest song as my wife and I can, but the one word of Mandarin that they really know is pigu, which means derriere. And it is our family, you know, get your pigu in the shower, get your pigu ready to go, that sort of thing. And she felt she couldn't really, you know, get much done in a Chinese class when all she could say was pigu. So she went up to the teacher and explained in English. I think maybe you read the form without really understanding what's at work here.
And do you speak French?
Not very well, not at all. In fact, my wife complains that my French has gotten worse since we got married, and particularly now because our daughters can translate for me. So, no, not very good. I mean, I do what I can. We do try and speak French when we're there.
My guest is NPR's Scott Simon. If you have a question for him, you're welcome to give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. So I think one of the things your listeners do know about you is that you love the Cubs. And as you wrote in your book about this, it was 2 years ago, I think, that it came out, My Cubs, A Love Story.
Yes.
To be devoted to the Chicago Cubs is to carry a torch of love that defies comparison. So we've got a lot of Cubs fans listening, and of course we've got some Sox and some Cardinals fans listening.
Oh, I'll bet. Yes, you sure do. There certainly are some Cardinal fans there.
Yes.
I'm going to be doing a story, by the way, for CBS on the new announcer for the Chicago White Sox.
Oh.
Jason Benetti.
Yes.
Interesting
and
guy.
Yes, and he's been on the 21st a couple of times.
Okay, good.
Yes.
All right, I will mention that to him.
Yeah. So I wonder, do you start every year with fresh hope?
Oh, gosh, yes. I start the year. I don't even have to start the year. It's all year round I have fresh hope. Absolutely.
But
I was hoping they would have been a little more active in the off-season market. I don't know quite how to explain what Theo has in mind. I can't, you know, I have to assume he's got some kind of master strategy, but there's still time after all.
And so I wonder how you adjust your mindset from the Billy Goat curse and all those years and then the World Series and then the past 2 years. I mean, it's like
when you're one of the richest, most successful franchises in baseball, and there's no excuse for you to lose. Yes, I know.
Yes.
It's been a
transition. Thanks for adding that.
It's been a transition. I don't mind making it. I don't mind saying it. I don't mind making it. I think that's what it should have always been. You know, the problem with the Cubs over the years, and let's of course exclude the possibility of a curse because we don't believe in that.
In Billy Goat
curse. Yeah, the curse of the Billy Goat. But yeah, there was never any reason for it. It's not like the Cubs were penurious when it came to paying players. Mr. Wrigley was always a very generous owner. The Tribune Corporation, that wasn't the problem. There were a lot of different factors. And I think day baseball might have been a factor. It might still be a factor every now and then when you get into the dog days of August and now increasingly September. So I don't know how to put my finger on it. But in any event, I think there was a mindset that took hold for many, many years. And thankfully, that has been changed. And I think there's no reason for the Cubs not to be as successful year in and year out as the Boston Red Sox.
But how do you shift from lovable losers to World Series to what the Cubs are now?
I don't find winning any less lovable.
Great.
I think, you know, that's fine with me. I tell you, there is still a quality of Cubdom, and it was underscored for me when they gave out the World Series rings in the months following their victory in the World Series, and they gave them out to all the office personnel as well as the players. And then, of course, you might remember that they gave it out to they gave a ring to, God bless him, the unfortunate man whose name was forever stained in history for, I don't think he really did interfere with Moises Alou making the catch over by the third baseline, but in any event, Stephen Bartman got a ring too. And I thought that said a lot about the character of the Cubs that has continued decade after decade, ownership after ownership, that they would understand that by giving him a ring, it was a way of saying, in a way that no other gesture could, you're a part of this group of people that love our team.
I'm sure you've seen that Cubs chairman Joe Ricketts has been in the news lately.
Yes.
With the revelation of racist emails coming to light. And I wonder if you think it's harder or becoming harder and harder to keep politics separate from being a sports fan.
For some people, obviously. I don't have any problem with the Joe Ricketts part. I have a problem with his emails, which I think are reprehensible. He doesn't have any role in running the team. I think his son, Tom Ricketts, who does run the team, and Laura Ricketts, a very active part-time owner who is a member of Chicago's Gay and Lesbian Hall of Fame and is a famous, I think, on the left political activist. He has no role in the team, so I have no problem saying that the children don't have to answer for the infractions and the sins of the father. I have a harder time with them re-signing Addison Russell after charges of domestic abuse. I don't like that at all. I don't think he gets exonerated if he has a good season. I understand Theo Epstein said, look, he's in therapy. We're working with him. We want to give him a chance at redemption. I want to keep my heart open to that. But I had more of a problem with that than any emails sent by Joe Ricketts.
Well, and it's hard, right? Because I feel like this is where sports and society collide. And I couldn't help but think about a story you had in your My Cubs book about President Obama hosting the Cubs when they won the
Yes.
World Series and talking about how he sees a direct line from Jackie Robinson and sports being integrated to his election as our first black president. And I wonder, do you think we don't take seriously enough the way that sports like baseball can influence the rest of our society?
I don't know if we don't take it seriously enough. And I want to be, I want to be careful about it because I do think, and I say this having written a book about Jackie Robinson, I'm not one for trying to mix politics and national and international affairs with sports. I think they're separate entities, and I think it's rare when a sports story becomes a part of general U.S. history. That, however, absolutely happened with Jackie Robinson.
And you could argue it's happening with the NFL now.
Yes, you could. Absolutely, you could. I think that's between Colin Kaepernick and demonstration. Yes, absolutely. Not to mention I think an important story happens to be the concussion story and the human damage that I think we're beginning to recognize that should have recognized for the past 10 or 15 years that football.
So how do you reconcile that?
You know, I did not watch a lot of football this year. I confess I did watch when the Bears got into the playoffs because, you know, you wake me up in the middle of the night and I'm still a Bears fan. But I don't enjoy the season nearly as much as I used to. And I felt very sorry for the kicker. I'm conveniently drawing a blank on his name. But
yeah,
you know, the last
I am
minute.
Too. And I'm, yeah, it's
well,
okay.
Well, nobody may utter his name again. God bless
He's
him.
He's probably happy.
He made three,
we're not remembering
He
his
made
name,
three
right?
field goals.
Here we go. Cody Parkey. Thank you, the producer.
Cody
helping
Parkey,
me out
thank
with
you
that.
Very much.
All right. Scott Simon is the Weekend Edition Saturday host. You can hear him this Saturday and every Saturday on this NPR station. Scott, thanks for talking to us. It's been great to have you back in Illinois Airwaves during the week.
Great to be back in Illinois. Thanks for asking.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Illinois is home to lots of scientific research, whether we're talking about the Peoria Ag Lab, Fermi and Argonne National Laboratories in Chicago's suburbs, or at our universities. The U of I's National Center for Supercomputing Applications, for example, is right across the street from our studios in Urbana. So much of this research and the people who are doing it depends on funding from the federal government, and a lot of that comes through the National Science Foundation. The NSF spends a total of about $300 million a year on academic research in Illinois alone. It also means when the government shuts down, even partially, that causes ripple effects for scientists all over the country and right here in Illinois. We wanted to talk about this, how it affects all of us while we were in Washington, D.C. Fleming Krim is the chief operating officer of the National Science Foundation. I had a chance to speak with him yesterday afternoon in person at NPR headquarters here in Washington. Fleming Krim, welcome to the 21st. Thanks so much for coming here.
Thank you.
I wanted to start by asking about science news that maybe isn't in the purview of the National Science Foundation, but it's about the Mars rover opportunity, which was unfortunately declared kind of dead yesterday in terms of not hearing from the rover. But I feel like we had such a moment and we got so much great research from it. It really was a time where a lot of Americans were really excited about space. And how important is that? These scientific advances for the general population to understand and be excited about?
Well, you know, everything that excites folks about science is good for the nation, it's good for the National Science Foundation, and it's good for the entire scientific enterprise. That excitement is what makes people notice and inspires people.
That's a little bit different than what the work that you all do at the National Science Foundation, though.
Yes, the National Science Foundation is in the business of supporting fundamental research. That is, research that has long-term goals, long-term payoffs, but those payoffs are not the kind that can be realized immediately, so it's not the sort of thing that private industry would fund. So our goal is to identify the very best science we can through a competitive process, fund the very best ideas, and some of these ideas are going to transform society. We don't know when we fund them which ones those will be, but that's the bet we make, and that's what we do for the citizens of the country, is to make that bet.
I wonder if you can give us a snapshot of how big the NSF budget is and what kind of research. Is it primarily academic research that you all are funding?
The National Science Foundation budget is almost $8 billion, and the National Science Foundation sends 93% of that money out the door to scientists. So we have a very small overhead. Academic research is our primary target. We are really looking toward supporting research in the universities, and that can mean a lot of different things. That can mean supporting individual investigators, somebody in a laboratory with a few graduate students. It can mean supporting a center like the Engineering Research Center. It can mean supporting something like NCSA at the University of Illinois that you mentioned. It can also mean supporting things like large telescopes and accelerators in big facilities. So we support that entire range. Now, we fund about 25% of all of the basic research in the country. But we are, for example, the funder of half of the physical sciences research. In some cases, we're the only game in town. We fund 80% of the academic computer science research.
And so when it comes to something like the federal government shutdown, first of all, we've heard some optimism from the members of Congress we've spoken to this week about the fact there probably will not be a government shutdown on Friday. I'm speaking to you on Wednesday. How do you deal with all of this uncertainty just in the short term? I don't even want to get to last month. I just want to talk about this week.
We are hopeful but prudent. So what we are doing is we are, as we did before the last lapse, we are getting our ducks in a row so that we will be able to deal with the consequence of the shutdown. That means a lot of different things that I can go into. But we're organizing ourselves, setting priorities, and mostly hoping that we don't need to execute those plans.
I wonder how the 35-day partial government shutdown affected you all at NSF. First, just I wonder, did you have researchers working?
Well, now, the National Science Foundation, as I said, sends out its money to researchers in universities, and the people who had received their money could keep going. However, there were a lot of consequences. 93% of our staff, our program officers, people who evaluate and work on with the researchers, they were furloughed. They weren't working. But there were a lot of activities, particularly in the days right after the holidays, that just didn't happen. You know, not everybody realizes how much effort it takes to vet and fund proposals. We evaluate them with panels of experts, and then program officers organize their portfolio. During the 2 weeks before we returned, we missed over 100 panels involving 700 reviewers and almost 2,000 proposals. That's work that has to be rescheduled. That's work that didn't happen. Those are proposals that won't be funded until later, won't even be evaluated until later because we were shut down.
And so are you essentially saying that you lost a month of work for all of the research you would have funded?
We lost a month of getting the fund, of evaluating proposals and getting the funding out to people. And it plays forward in that delays, for example, that delays a solicitation that then comes out a little bit too late to get funded this fiscal year. There are those kinds of consequences. We're in the midst of evaluating what all those consequences will be. But we are already seeing some of them, but we're carefully trying to understand the consequences.
My guest is Fleming Krim. He's the Chief Operating Officer of the National Science Foundation. And Fleming, when we're thinking about Illinois, our national labs, whether it's Fermi or Argonne, our universities, we've mentioned U of I gets a significant amount of NSF funding. I'm thinking of the Peoria Ag Lab, which was shut down it wasn't even open during the shutdown. I wonder how organizations like that, if you have, for example, like the Peoria Ag Lab and they're not open for a month, how you can even calculate that effect.
Well, there are a couple of things. Because of the way we send out our funding, we were often able to encourage people to draw down funds we'd obligated they had not withdrawn yet in order to keep going. We saw this coming. But what we were afraid of was that some of our major facilities, our telescopes, the LIGO, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, any number of facilities were going to run out of money and have to furlough their employees. That didn't happen primarily because of a lot of careful planning and a lot of actions that were taken during the shutdown. The thing that really was hard on universities was they couldn't draw cash down from the NSF bank, essentially. We'd obligated the money. We couldn't send it to them. So what they had to do in many cases was to buffer their people. They carried their people. And then the first day we reopened, 16,000 grantees drew down $200 million. On a normal day, they draw down about $20 million. So there was a pent-up demand.
And I wonder if you found a disproportionate effect on certain kinds of projects or scientists?
We found that the pain was pretty evenly distributed. There were a few striking cases, like people who had postdoctoral appointments who didn't get paid because their money came directly from NSF and our bank was closed. People who were paid on grants were okay if the grant had money or the university was willing to carry them. So that was a really, you think of our young...
So those are younger scientists, you're
our
saying.
Our young, most ambitious scientists.
The scientists who obviously also can't afford to maybe weather also a month of this. You're saying postdocs,
right.
Graduate students, those are the people who might have lost salary.
Well, and another group of people that we heard from were young scientists writing their first proposal to NSF, trying to get into the system, get started. These kind of delays are a little bit discouraging to them. However, there's one more group of people I want to mention, and those are our employees. We had 1,500 NSF federal employees who didn't get paid for two paychecks. Now, that is tough, and it's really important not only to think about the scientific consequences, but the consequences to the morale of the workers and just the personal lives of these people. And these are the folks who are evaluating these proposals and making the foundation work.
Do you have a lot of contractors who work with you as well?
We have contractors that work in some support functions. And let me give you an example of a positive outcome for contractors. Much of our IT services through contractors, because they had tasks that were described. They could keep working and, in fact, kept some of the electronic systems that allowed people to send in proposals running. Other contractors, and it depended on the organization with whom we contracted, weren't able to keep working and didn't get paid.
Fleming, I wonder what you might say. I bet there are people listening now who think, why does this matter? Why is the government even paying for scientific research? Why isn't this something that the private sector is funding because they're the ones who might profit from it?
You're asking a question that's very important to answer. The sort of fundamental research that the National Science Foundation supports is research to understand nature at its deepest and most profound level. And that doesn't change your life tomorrow. That changes your life in 10 years or 20 years or 30 years. And there's a whole zoo of examples, everything from the digital library that became Google, microwave amplification of stimulated emission of radiation that became a laser. Einstein didn't do general relativity so I could get to Starbucks, but my GPS won't work without general relativity. There are all those sorts of things that we're investing in now, and private industry can't invest in that because it doesn't yield a return soon enough. This is a scientific commons, and we have to fund this scientific commons for our nation to flourish.
And so when we look at that, you and I were talking before we went on air about that trend line, and in the 1970s, how much money the government put into this research to now, and it's really gone down. So I wonder how you think we compare and compete when we're thinking about a global sphere and global scientific advancement. Where does the U.S. rank?
So that's an interesting question, of course, because, in fact, what it is, it has gone down fractionally, not absolutely. But about 1970, we funded roughly, the federal government funded roughly two-thirds of the fundamental research, of all of R&D. Now it funds about one-third of all of R&D. But a lot of that is development work. And that's the work that is closest to the product. And private industry needs to realize a profit from that investment. So that tends to be shorter-term investment. That long-term transformative investment I was talking about is harder for industry to make, and that's what the National Science Foundation does. Globally, we put about 2.8% of our gross domestic product into R&D. Now, I'm talking about both research and development. There are 9 countries that put a larger fraction in. And there are a number that put a smaller fraction
what
in.
What are the 9 countries?
I don't know if I'll name them all,
okay.
But some of
Give
them will
couple.
Surprise you. I mean, Finland, Israel, Japan, let me see, Switzerland puts in just about the same, and I don't have my chart in front
that's
of me.
That's all right. That's but interesting.
Yeah. And that's changed. 20 years ago, there was one country that put in a larger fraction of the United States than the United States. Now there are 9.
Fleming Krim is the Chief Operating Officer for the National Science Foundation here with me at NPR in Washington. Thanks for coming down. I appreciate it.
I'm happy to have been here.
That does it for us today. If you have the NPR One app, you can download that from wherever you get your smartphone apps. It's a good way to find past shows. It's pretty simple. You download it, set your home station, and if you search for the 21st to follow us, that's one way to listen to past shows. But we're also available on iTunes, Android, most of the ways you get your podcasts. Our Twitter handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. We've got lots of pictures we've been tweeting this week of our trip here in Washington. We're also on Facebook. If you want to comment on what we're working on, post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air, just search for the 21st and message us there. All of those links, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, all you have to remember is our website. That's 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Bobby McSwine is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to all the folks at NPR in Washington for hosting us this week, especially Emily Dagger, Natasha Branch, and Kevin Waite. We couldn't have done these shows without you. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks to you for listening. I'm Nyla Boodoo.